Welcome to the Blue Ocean Church Ann Arbor Linton podcast. I'm Emily, one of the co-pastors of Blue Ocean, and this is part 3 of 6. I'll begin by giving you a brief summary of chapter 3 of The Cross and the Lynching Tree by James Cone. I'll follow that with a couple of questions to think about during the week, and then end with a time of meditation. Chapter 3 is titled, Bearing the Cross and Staring Down the Lynching Tree. So in the last chapter, James Cone wrestled with the reasons Reinhold Niebuhr's theology prevented him from sacrificing anything significant to move the cause of civil rights forward more quickly. And Cone talked about how Niebuhr intellectually understood that preaching the gospel and that the love that it demands in the form of justice should cost him something, and yet he never took his faith far enough for it to actually do so. Even in his own book, Leaves from the Notebook of a Tamed Cynic, Reinhold Niebuhr himself wrote, "If a gospel is preached without opposition, it is simply not the gospel which resulted in the cross. And yet here I've been preaching it for 13 years and crying, 'Woe unto you if all men speak well of you,' and yet I leave without a serious controversy in the whole 13 years." That was speaking of his time as a pastor at a church in Detroit. And James Cone concluded that Niebuhr's privilege is what prevented him from putting anything tangible on the line. His reputation, his job, even his life. That he benefited too much from slow change, and he wasn't able to empathize deeply enough with the suffering of Black people. Now chapter 3 finds Cone contrasting the limits of Niebuhr's faith with the devotion of Martin Luther King Jr.'s. So he says that unlike Niebuhr, King understood that taking up the cause of the gospel in regards to civil rights very well may cost him his life, not to mention the many lesser losses along the way. But before Cone delves into talking about the crux of Martin King's faith, he talks about how the death of Emmett Till catalyzed the Black population into action. It was 1955. Brown versus Board of Education had just passed the year before, saying that racial segregation of children in public schools was unconstitutional. Southern whites were angry about this, and they found ways to underscore their ongoing societal dominance. Emmett Till was a 14-year-old boy from Chicago, somewhat more naive to the more extreme racism of the South. He was visiting relatives in Mississippi when a 21-year-old white woman named Carolyn Bryant accused Emmett of whistling or catcalling her outside of the grocery store that she and her husband owned. A few days later, Carolyn Bryant's husband, Roy, and her half-brother, J.W. Milan, went to the home where Emmett Till was staying. They kidnapped him at 2 a.m. They beat him beyond recognition. They shot him in the head. They tied something heavy to his body, and they threw him in the local river. James Cone didn't know it when he wrote this book back in 2011, but in 2017, an interview with an elderly Carolyn Bryant was released by a historian at Duke, in which Bryant, this is Emmett Till's accuser, admitted that her accusations were false. She claimed that she was abused by her husband, and she was scared of him, and so she was pressured into making these false statements. So for decades, she said nothing. And while it's important that she recanted her original story to acknowledge the glaring racism that everybody already knew was the root cause of the violence, it was also like slathering salt on a gaping wound that she first slashed open in 1955. The death of Emmett Till, a 14-year-old boy, was so shocking that it galvanized people into action. And for those of us who weren't alive in the mid-1950s, we might compare it to the death of Trayvon Martin in its audacity. Young, innocent Black boys, both presumed guilty by angry men, who then audaciously took their lives and got off scot-free. James Cone talks about how Emmett Till's mother, Mamie Till Bradley, refused to allow Emmett Till's suffering and death to be swept under the table. That she insisted on having an open casket for a 3-day viewing in Chicago where more than 600,000 people visited to see the body. And in this, I see her humanizing her son, She's not allowing the mess created by his sacrifice to just be swept under the table. She seemed to be saying, look, this is what you did, white America. This is your mess. And people will hold you responsible. And through the outrage and the suffering over Emmett's death, we will eventually bring an end to all of this oppression. Mamie Till Bradley found meaning in her son's death through the story of Jesus' lynching on the cross. At the funeral, she cried out, Lord, you gave your son to remedy a condition. But who knows but what the death of my only son might bring an end to lynching. And in the midst of her grief, Mamie Till Bradley had a mystical experience where she said that a strange voice spoke to her words of comfort and encouragement, and she understood that voice to be the resurrected Jesus. Cone notes that this is not unlike a mystical experience that Martin Luther King Jr. had in the midst of his ministry. One night, amidst great threats against his life, bombings, lynchings, King got up in the middle of the night and he went downstairs to pray. And Cone writes this. He says, later recalling this incident, King told how fear drove him from bed to the kitchen where he prayed out loud, pleading, Lord, I'm down here trying to do what's right. But Lord, I must confess that I'm weak now. I'm faulting. I'm losing my courage. And yet then, just like Mrs. Bradley, Emmett Till's mother, King said that he heard a voice that said, Martin Luther, stand up for righteousness. Stand up for justice. Stand up for truth. And lo, I will be with you even to the end of the world. For both Martin King and Mamie Bradley, these mystical encounters with Jesus were what they held on to in the midst of trials and grief. They both felt the solidarity of a Savior who had also experienced suffering, and they both held to the promise of resurrection, right? That even though Emmett Till might die, and even if King lost his life, they both had hope that the Spirit was moving and using them to bring about change. Now, that thought is controversial, because many oppressed people feel that they're told to suffer for their own redemption. That suffering is romanticized when there's nothing romantic or heroic about suffering. It's just tragic. And James Cone himself, he wrestles with this thought at the end of the chapter. And he writes, I too was slow to embrace King's view of redemptive suffering. Have not blacks, women, and poor people throughout the world suffered enough? Giving value to suffering seems to legitimize it. Whatever we might say about the limits of King's perspective on the cross and redemptive suffering, he didn't legitimize suffering. On the contrary, he tried to end it, sacrificing his own life for the cause of others, end quote. So much of the second half of chapter 3 shows how Martin Luther King Jr. was willing to embrace suffering and death, but it's also crystal clear that he didn't seek it or desire it. He saw suffering as a natural result of picking up and bearing our crosses, which was a theme that he often preached. And this theme comes from Matthew 16, which says, Then Jesus said to his disciples, Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it. What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world and yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? This picture of bearing our crosses also comes from the picture of Simon of Cyrene, who was the man who was ordered to help Jesus carry his literal cross to Golgotha. So Cyrene, where Simon was from, is a modern-day area in Libya, and many African Americans have found solidarity with Simon. King preached this. He says, I think one day God will remember that it was a black man that helped his son in the darkest and most desperate moment of his life. It was a black man who picked up that cross for him and who took that cross up to Calvary. God will remember this. And in all of our struggles for peace and security, freedom and human dignity, one day God will remember it was a black man who aided his only begotten son in the darkest hour of his life. White Americans sometimes forget that Martin Luther King Jr. was arrested and thrown in jail 29 times. His nonviolent resistance tactics disrupted day-to-day life for many people, and white people in particular were annoyed by the way that he drew attention to the oppression of black people. He called people to break unjust laws and to pay the consequences in order to reveal the unjustness of the law. Even today, when nonviolent resistance tactics like this are used, people often complain. I think of when Black Lives Matter protesters, they effectively shut down an interstate in Minneapolis. And the reason they chose that interstate was because in the late 1950s and early 60s, I-94 there was deliberately bulldozed right down the center of a thriving middle-class African-American community in Minneapolis. It effectively displaced its residents. Right? They chose to go through a middle-class black neighborhood rather than the many white neighborhoods surrounding. So standing in that interstate is a way for people to call attention to injustices. It's saying, hey, do you remember when there was a thriving black middle class here and the white government decided to destroy it because black people had less social power than white people? We're still experiencing the consequences of that. Minnesota has one of the worst income gaps between blacks and whites in the nation. So people are willing to be arrested to call our attention to injustices, and that's directly in line with what Martin Luther King Jr.'s nonviolent resistance tactics called for. And we white people don't always like to remember what a radical King was, but he called for people to place their actual bodies on the line in nonviolent ways to jolt our culture into paying attention to our actions. And that's what prophets do, right? They see how things could be. They imagine how things should be. And then they call us to implement that ideal. And James Cone says this is the key difference between Reinhold Niebuhr and Martin Luther King. Martin Luther was an idealist, and he understood the cost of calling people to enact justice now for the sake of the oppressed. Niebuhr considered himself a realist, willing to deal with the imperfections so long as he could hope that things would eventually change. And what Cone invites us to realize is that one of those voices, King's, is the voice of the oppressed, while the other is the voice of the privileged. Because white people haven't always been able to understand the urgency of the need to enact justice. We haven't been able to fully understand or embrace people like Martin Luther King Jr. in his time. But rather, we tend to embrace a sanitized version of him as this peaceful, love everyone preacher. But like Jesus, Martin Luther stirred the cultural pot to the point that we killed him. So if Jesus also was a pot stirrer, calling for justice to the point of being killed, do we also misunderstand Jesus when we view him as a peaceful, love everyone preacher? And what Cone is saying is yes to that. So that's the main gist of chapter 3. And at this point, I'm going to move into asking a couple of questions, and feel free to hit the pause button after each question if you just want to think about it yourself or if you're discussing this in a group. So the first question is, what are 1 to 2 things that you learned from this chapter? And question 2 is, where do you feel challenged, stretched, and/or provoked by Cone? And now we'll move into a time of meditation. So to close out, let's just take some time of silence to sit with our thoughts. And during this time, ask the Holy Spirit if there's anything that she would like to say to you in this space. Feel free to pause until you're done. And then the closing song, Strange Fruit, sung by Billie Holiday, will end the podcast.
Strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black body swinging in the southern breeze, strange from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene, gallant south. The bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the tree to drop. Here's a strange and bitter